I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. There were a lot of people who wanted to be interim district attorney of Philadelphia after Seth Williams resigned and was found guilty of bribery. He's in the federal detention center and will be sentenced in October. Our guest, Kelly Hodge, was selected by the Common Pleas Board of Judges to fill out his term in what turned out to be a contentious competition. Voters will elect a new district attorney in November. She's the first African-American woman to hold the position and will be on the job until the end of the year. Hodge spent 7 years as a defender out of law school and has spent 8 years as a city prosecutor. Pennsylvania Governor Tom Corbett chose her to be the city's safe school advocate, and she worked for a time at the University of Virginia's Title IX program as diversity coordinator, and she joins us here on Radio Times. And Kelly Hodge, congratulations. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
There were, 14 people that applied for this position. You were one of them. Why did you want to be interim district attorney?
I think when I saw the opportunity, when it presented itself, I looked at the office and knowing the office and having worked in the office for a period of time from 2004 to 2011, but having maintained relationships with people in the criminal justice community in Philadelphia, as well as specifically in the DA's office, I just felt that I could step back into the office if given the chance and do a good job. So it was more of a continuing kind of appreciation for the work of the office, for the hard work that the district attorneys do day in and day out, as well as my respect for the criminal justice system. That's why I decided to go ahead and put my name in the hat, so to speak.
What did the office need? And I'm thinking after the district attorney, Seth Williams, found guilty of bribery, what kind of support did this is to the lawyers there, the people that work in the office, what do they need?
I think that it's the attorneys in the office, it's the judges here in the city, it's the citizens in this community that make up Philadelphia, and those who come into the city to work or to enjoy all that Philadelphia has to offer. All of them needed to know that if for some reason they had a touch or a contact with the criminal justice system, that the facts and the law were going to be the focal point and not anything else. So for me, and I'm sure for anyone who expressed an interest in the position, the goal was to make sure that the office and the work of the district attorney's office was focused on the cases and the victims and those individuals who had contact with the criminal justice system, and not on any of, I would say, the external distractions that were being associated with the office.
The distractions coming from Seth Williams.
Correct.
And the reputation, I guess, of the office itself.
Correct. The people who are in the district attorney's office have worked tirelessly for many of them for many, many years. And they continue to do that work in spite of a circumstance that was not of their own making, nor could they control, nor did they contribute to. And so I think from my position, I looked at this opportunity as a chance to be a person who is familiar with the criminal justice system, who knows how to try cases, who knows what the district attorneys have to do day in and day out to do their job well, and to hopefully refocus a sense of energy and commitment to that work, not just the attorneys themselves, but also to refocus the community in the faith and trust that the work is being done well.
What do you think you can do in 5 months?
My goal, as I've said before, is to hopefully make it that I depart this position having left the office in a better position than when I entered it. That can come in many different ways and manifest itself in many different ways. The one way could be just the overall mental wellness and feeling of the attorneys in the space, knowing that, again, people are focused on the work that they're doing and nothing else. For the community, for the citizens of Philadelphia, it is knowing that when their case is brought before the court, or when they have an incident that unfortunately may happen to them in the community, that, again, this office is here and I am here to make sure that they are heard and that justice is served, that the right thing is done at the end of the day. If I can reinforce that, that's a step in the right direction. I think also during my 5 months, there's a campaign that's going to be going on for district attorney. There's going to be a significant need for smooth transition. And so that is also something that I am looking at and acknowledge will take up a decent portion of the time that I'm in this position. There's obviously gun violence and the opioid epidemic. Those are key things that I'm looking at and have looked at, and I was paying attention to even prior to becoming the interim district attorney. So those things were not off my radar. They've always been very, very important to me.
Did you ever want to be district attorney of Philadelphia?
I think I did. Yes. I don't think I would have put myself in this position to hopefully be considered and now be where I am if I didn't have that in the back of my mind at some point in time. And so
I did consider it.
I don't know. I think that I'm enjoying what I'm doing now. Obviously, I truly appreciate the opportunity that's been presented to me. And I've now learned coming back into the office since leaving and returning a little bit about myself, and that once you're here, you can kind of never leave it. It's always kind of a little bit ingrained in you. And that part of me is the need to care about the community and hopefully help people. And so I think that is something that could definitely entice me to want to go ahead and consider things down the road. But I'm not putting the cart before the horse. My focus right now is just on doing a good job for the time I'm in this position.
Is it significant that you're the first African-American woman to hold this job?
Yes, it is.
Does it open the door for other African-American women, you think, in the office?
Absolutely. I hope so. I think not just in my position in this office in Philadelphia, I think that nationally. I know that the percentage of women who sit similarly situated to me at this point, meaning women who are African-American females heading Commonwealth attorneys or state's attorneys or district attorney's offices around the country, is small. I also know that generally the pool of women attorneys who are prosecutors around the country is also small or clearly not as high as it would be for other for males or for Caucasian females. And I look and I would like to see the opportunity that I have been presented with as maybe an impetus to allow others to also come through the door.
You have worked for a time as a defense attorney and also as a prosecutor. Is that important to have both sides of the court system?
Yes, I think it is. I think that there has been a true advantage in how I have developed professionally, how I view things, how I kind of the lens I use to analyze cases, to consider life circumstances, to weigh evidence and facts. It comes from what I've learned very early on in my career as a public defender in Virginia and handling the types of cases I handled there, and then transitioning and becoming a prosecutor here in Philadelphia and handling the cases and things that I handled here. It is giving me the ability, I would like to think, to see things on a more holistic level and to hopefully make decisions with that in mind.
You mentioned gun violence, also the opioid epidemic. What can you, as the interim district attorney, what can you do about gun violence in Philadelphia?
Unilaterally, probably not as much as needs to be done to really address it and really make an impact. So it involves partnering with law enforcement, with Commissioner Ross, of course, with the mayor's office, with community partners, those people who are continuously impacted by this day in and day out. The information that we receive, that my office receives or law enforcement receives regarding how to go ahead and make sure that the access to guns is not so rampant, to make sure that when things happen involving guns, that we are looking to immediately try to get the person or that the access to that gun off the street. Those are things that involve a team approach. You have to go ahead and work with others in order to be effective. A lot of what the district attorney's office does is reactive. We have cases and things that are brought to us. We charge them and we prosecute them. But equally important to that, in my opinion, is the prevention piece, is to prevent future victims of violence. And that involves that working relationship with those other entities that are critical and key.
Is that also true for the opioid epidemic, in that the district attorney's office needs to work with others to try to figure out how to address this problem?
Absolutely. It's a public health matter. I believe that
less, more public health, less criminal?
Both. I wouldn't say one is more important than the other, because you obviously have people that are creating the access and facilitating the just overwhelming amount of heroin and opioid related drugs that people are able to get and then become addicted to and then continue to have the need for. They have an addiction that they are battling, and we have to address those who create that access. So that is one component. But on the public health side, I think it's very, very important for myself and others that work in the law enforcement realm to acknowledge, and I know we have, the need to go ahead and appreciate that it is a public health crisis. And how do we go ahead and really address it from that end? What can we do with those individuals who are coming into the health system and either receiving treatment for things, and how can we go ahead and make it so that we work to understand how to better go ahead and treat individuals so that hopefully the potential for the use and abuse is not there.
We've done whole hours on civil forfeiture, but this is a controversial issue. The former DA, Seth Williams, criticized for seizing properties of people either not found guilty of a particular crime or not even charged or involved in a crime. Where do you stand on civil forfeiture?
Well, I will say that civil forfeiture, I know, has had definitely a history that has, as you stated, been controversial. And I think very recently a new statute's been enacted by the Commonwealth regarding it as of July 1 of 2017. My position is that we are going to follow the process and procedures that have been put in place by the state, that those past missteps that have been either alleged or that have been shown to have taken place, hopefully have been resolved with this new statute. And as always, the district attorney's office is going to follow the law.
About a minute before we have to say goodbye, so we get to the end of December. How do you know, what is your criteria for doing a good job?
Hopefully, my criterion would be that the office is respected, that individually, the work I have done along with the deputies and leadership in the office has been respected, that people view the office as what its mission statement is, which is truly a voice for victims, that we are advocating on behalf of all the citizens in Philadelphia, and that we are looking to make true impact on reducing crime in the city and making this city as wonderful and as livable for everyone here as we know it is.
On that note, Kelly Hodge, thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome. And she is the interim district attorney of Philadelphia. She will be on the job until the end of this year. We're going to take a very short break, shift gears. We'll be talking about boredom. What's so interesting about boredom? Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Artie Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Well, boredom has become an interesting, even fascinating topic. The third International Interdisciplinary Boredom Conference was held this spring at the University of Warsaw in Poland. Scientists have been using brain studies and psychological research to understand this all too common and unpleasant experience. Here's a scene from the FX TV series Louis, in which Louis C.K. is driving his daughters to visit their grandmother. In the background is Irish music on the car radio.
I'm cool. I'm cool.
Because I'm bored is a useless thing to say. I mean, you live in a great, big, vast world that you've seen none percent of. And even the inside of your own mind is endless. It goes on forever inwardly. Do you understand? Being the fact that you're alive is amazing. So you don't get to be bored. When you say, I'm bored...
Well, our guest Mary Mann decided to explore and understand boredom by writing her book, Yawn, Adventures in Boredom. She works as a private researcher, as an associate, a writing associate at the Cooper Union. Mary Mann, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Also with us is James Dankert. He's a professor of cognitive neuroscience at the University of Waterloo in Canada and director of the university's Dankert Attention Group. James Dankert, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499 to join our conversation about boredom. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Mary, let me begin with you. How did you personally get interested in boredom?
I think it started kind of when I was in graduate school. I went to school to get my MFA in writing, and one of the worst things that anyone can tell you in a workshop when you're writing is that your work is boring.
Yes.
It's something that everybody worries about because all the other things that are bad, you know, like hurting people's feelings or being offensive or all these different things, don't really register if no one's reading it, so if no one's interested enough to read it. So I started getting interested in, like, what is the thing that we're scared of when we worry about being boring, and that got into boredom and just sort of spiraled from there.
How about for you, James? I was reading about your interests through people who have had brain injury. Help us understand that.
Yeah, so I worked as a clinical neuropsychologist for many years and saw young men mostly who'd had brain injuries, typically from things like car accidents, who reported being more bored after their injury than they were beforehand. It's as if the things that used to satisfy them before their injury just were no longer doing it for them. They were no longer satisfactory to them. And so I wanted to understand that from an organic perspective, what had changed in their brains that led to this sort of increased level of boredom.
Did you find out what part of their brain was affected that could affect boredom?
Well, we don't have definitive answers on these things. It's sort of the research is ongoing. We do know that one part of the brain that is known as the orbital frontal cortex is very important for sort of processing reward value, whether or not you're enjoying something and getting pleasure out of something, or indeed whether or not something is sort of negatively valued as well. And that's the part of the brain that's often injured in these the people who've suffered these kinds of brain injuries. So it may be the case, we don't have data on this yet, but it may be the case that they've just had a sort of threshold reset for what counts as enjoyable or satisfactory for them. Mm. And that's also a brain area that we know is involved in addictions of various kinds. And so it's dysfunctional in people who are suffering from drug and alcohol addictions.
Well, here's a really boring question. And to you, Mary, and to you, James. And I was thinking about boredom as sort of like art, which is sometimes is hard to define, but you know what it is when you see it. Mary, how do you understand what boredom is?
I experience it and have understood it from interviews with a whole bunch of different people that it's sort of like this irritable restlessness. Mm-hmm. And actually, I had a chance to speak with James while writing this book, and we talked about that a little bit as well. So I'll just shoot it back over to you, James.
Go ahead, James.
Sure. I mean, I think there's a controversy in the literature about whether or not boredom should be thought of as a low arousal or a high arousal event. I think, you know, the Louis C.K. Bit that you played at the start here has got children in the back of the car
bored
because they're not active. They're
yes.
not doing anything.
Right.
Right. And so that gives you the first impression that boredom is low arousal. Boredom is sort of an inactivity. But as Mary just pointed out, what we've found in several sort of studies is that really it's an agitated state. People are wanting to be engaged with the world. And because they're failing to satisfy that need, that want, they're agitated. They're restless. So we sort of describe it as an aggressively dissatisfying state where you want something. You have, I think the quote from Leo Tolstoy is a desire for desires. You want to be engaged with something, but whatever attempts you're making at engagement are not working, and that's felt as being very unsatisfactory and agitating.
Well, as you two were talking, Mary, I'm thinking of that word escape. And I think, I mean, if you're standing in line at the DMV, that is boring. I mean, there are many things that we have to do that's boring. And you want to get the heck out of there. Is escape or this desired escape, is that a feature of being bored?
Yeah, it seems to be. I mean, it certainly has a lot of relationship with feeling trapped. There's this great book, and I'm unfortunately blanking on the name of the author, who's wonderful, but it's Boredom, Young Men, Time, and Boredom in the Republic of Georgia.
Oh,
and it's
goodness.
All about, like, these young men who are sort of just trapped. They can't immigrate. They can't get good jobs. And it's really, it, like, can lead to some pretty just painful feelings of being trapped, of being really bored, of wanting to get an outlet in drinking if you can afford it, or sometimes feeling depressed. And I know James has done some studies on the difference between depression and boredom as well.
Yeah, which is interesting, because I could imagine, James, people thinking that there must be something depressive related to this feeling of boredom.
Well, so there's long been a very strong association between boredom and depression. So the two states, if you like, or the two experiences are very, very highly correlated. But the way I see the difference is that the individual who's suffering from depression sort of has these negative inward ruminations about themselves. What is wrong with the world is in them. Whereas the person who's experiencing boredom a lot sees that what is wrong with the world is out there. The world is not enough, and what is out there in the external environment is just not satisfactory. We still don't really know, you know, what turns one thing into another. You know, does boredom come first and depression follow later after sort of chronically experiencing boredom? That's one possibility, but we still don't really know how those two things relate in that causative way.
Mira is reading about some scientists who lived for a while in a volcano in Hawaii. I don't know much more than that. But they said one of the biggest problems or biggest challenges was boredom. And is boredom having nothing to do, or is it how we deal with having nothing to do?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I do tend to think that, and this is not my original idea, but like we have so much more to do than our ancestors, so we are kind of less bored, but we're more afraid of it. And so that can mean, like, talking about Louis C.K., he also has a bit about how people are literally killing each other and other people because they can't sit and just drive in their car. They also want to be connected. They want to be texting. They want to be doing other things. Like, to be with ourselves has gotten to be a little harder.
Is there a shame, Mary, that the people feel if they say, I'm bored, is there a shame associated with that, do you think?
There seems to be. Different people have different feelings about that, at least from who I've been able to interview. But a lot of people think that it means that they're boring, because there's that thing that I think a lot of parents or grandparents will tell you, like, only boring people get bored.
Exactly.
And it actually works out kind of the opposite in real life, because people with a low boredom threshold tend to be the risk takers who are like, let's go bungee jumping, you know, let's do a thing. So they'll probably have the best stories. I don't know if that's true in your experience, James.
Yeah. James, you want to add to that?
Go ahead.
Well,
there is that association that there's increased risk taking and increased impulsivity in those who experience boredom a lot. And I think that when you hear the you know, Louis C.K., I've heard that he's said that many times before, that you know really 9% of what's out there in the world, so you don't have the right to be bored. I think what he's expressing there is that boredom is a signal. Boredom tells you that whatever you're doing right now is not satisfying and you need to try and do something else. And for the people who don't experience it much, those are the people who just respond very adaptively and quickly to that signal. And the people who do experience boredom a lot are just failing to respond to that signal, that thing that your body is telling you. You need to do something else. You need to get engaged in something different, because what you're doing now isn't working. So I think the answer to your question is that it's boredom in and of itself is neither bad nor good. I mean, I think there's some associations between boredom and creativity that's out there in the literature as well. It's how we respond to it that makes it negative or positive for us.
And just a quick follow-up to that, James, the idea of boredom and creativity is what? Having the time to daydream, to think outside the box, stuff like that?
So there is only very little sort of research out there, but the idea being that, if the boredom is a signal that you need to sort of re-engage with the world, it might also help you re-engage with the world in novel ways. And so you might take those novel and creative ways and then run with them. So one of the things that we find in our research is that boredom and self-control are very strongly negatively related. So the more self-control you have over your behavior, your thoughts, and your actions, the less likely you are to be bored.
Hmm.
Well, that kind of self-control is also very critical for creativity. So I think we have these sort of mythical ideas about creativity that it just sort of comes out of nowhere and you know, brilliant ideas just form in the mind of the genius artist. But I think it takes a great deal of self-control and adaptive control of behavior to be creative. And so those kinds of relationships are the ones that we're exploring.
Mary, let me go back to you and even go back to some of the things that you write about in your book. You did interview a polyamory expert, and people sometimes complain that monogamy or long-term relationships are boring or the sex involved is boring. What did you learn?
Oh man, so many things. It was helpful for me actually, and on a personal level as well. I just got married, so I was thinking about that very common association between monogamy and monotony. I mean, they just sound alike. And there's so many TV shows and books and movies and things exploring this very common fear. And it was helpful for me to even see it acknowledged so bluntly in some of this research, because I feel like a lot of the time I got a chance to interview a couple different sex and relationship therapists,
mm-hmm.
and they were saying that most of the time couples don't want to use the word boring or bored when they're talking about their relationship, because it's so scary. There's this idea of like that as being contagious, and if you say it, it'll make it true, or it'll make you that thing. And so we're not always honest with each other about how we're feeling. And it's really nice to just be like, hey, I'm feeling like a little bit bored. Like, mm-hmm. let's do something. You know, it's nice to be able to be frank about that stuff.
Well, were these people that you interviewed, were they talking about then novelty, the idea of, as you say, monotony, monogamy, that the idea of novelty gets rid of some of that boredom?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's certainly the polyamory expert that I spoke to says that she thinks that everyone needs a certain degree of it, but it doesn't have to be always, I mean, obviously it doesn't always have to be in a third person.
Right.
But I do think there's something to be said for realizing that we don't know our partners as well as we ever think we do. And that's a little scary, but it also leaves open mm-hmm. all this opportunity for surprise
sure.
that I think sometimes gets canceled out when you're like, yeah, he uses this toothpaste and he likes this show and he, you know, these things are his character, so that's him.
James, what about this notion of novelty? Is that a way of addressing the problem of boredom?
Well, I don't think so. I think that there's a sense in which most of us are often seeking novel things. The amount that you desire novelty in your life might differ than it does for me, but you know, we all enjoy something new in our lives. But if you think about it carefully and take it to the absurd extreme, I mean, you can't constantly seek novelty. You know, every day you get up and you do some of the same things. You know, you go and do the same job, you've got the same relationships that you're engaging with. So most of your day, in fact, doesn't involve novelty. So I think instead, one of the things, and whether or not this relates to sexual relationships or other sort of relationships, one of the things that can combat boredom is just reframing the circumstance. So you might have monotony involved in your relationships, or you might have monotony involved in your work, but if you can reframe it to give it some other kind of sense of meaning, then you can avoid that sort of boredom. So the gentleman who his last name is very hard to pronounce, Mihai Csikszentmihalyi, who famous for talking about flow, he talks about people working on assembly lines who are doing extraordinarily monotonous and boring sort of jobs. But one particular individual he interviews, you know, makes a game or a competition out of each hour of his work on the assembly line, and avoids boredom by doing that. So he just reframed the problem. And you can imagine that rather than seeking novelty, that might be a better strategy for getting rid of boredom, because you can't perpetually seek novelty. It's just not feasible.
But I'm thinking about the novelty in our pocket or our pocketbook, Mary. I'm thinking about our cell phones, which, of course, you know, buzz us and bing us and distract us, but also connect us to the world. And it is a way of dealing with boredom or trying to get some kind of a novelty hit.
Yeah, and it is something, I mean, I think that's partly why so many people are in sort of popular culture right now talking about boredom, because that's something that we're all becoming a little bit aware of or concerned with, our need for, like, this immediate hit. But I think I agree with what James is saying about reframing as maybe being a more, certainly more efficient and productive thing. And it also goes back to creativity, like that person on the assembly line. Mm-hmm. Is thinking of a way to make it fun. He's having a creative solution. I have a good friend who works for the Foreign Service, and one of her first jobs was like stamping passports in Argentina, and it was super boring. And her and her coworkers would make a game of, like, you'd have to stamp the passports to the rhythm of a song, and if you messed it up, then you lost.
That's great.
And so that kind of stuff, I like knowing that stuff about people, the different ways that our minds like work around having this feeling.
Absolutely. Well, let's take a break and we'll get back to our conversation. We are talking about boredom on Radio Times today. And I have to say, one of the harshest criticisms that I get about the show from time to time is, that was a really boring show you did today. And that really hurts. Mary Mann is author of Yawn, Adventures in Boredom. James Dankert is professor of cognitive neuroscience at the University of Waterloo. That's in Canada. And he's also director of the university's Dankert Attention Group. We're talking about boredom. 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. I got a lot of comments here. Also, you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We'll be right back.
The windup and the 2-2 pitch. Oh, no, sir, wait a minute. The batter is calling for time. Looks like he's going and getting himself a new bat. And now there's a beach ball on the field. And the ball boys are discussing which one of them's going to go get it.
I never realized how boring this game is.
Can't go wrong with The Simpsons talking about baseball. We are talking about boredom with James Dankert and Mary Mann. Let me read a couple of comments here. A question from Mark. What's the difference between being bored with your life and being bored in that specific moment? A tweet from Sean, is the real word oppression, not boredom? A tweet from Matthew, is there a danger of always having phones to escape us from our boredom? What are boredom's benefits? Let me start with Mark's question. I'll put this to you, James, about the difference between just being bored with your life, which might be a little closer to depression, and just being bored in a specific moment, which is kind of vanilla boredom.
Well, I think that the distinction that Mark's making there is between state and trait boredom. So we might all have experienced boredom in that moment, you know, and we would refer to that as state boredom. And that's that signal that I talk about that sort of says, you know, whatever you're doing now, you just need to change. It's not satisfying for you. Being bored with your life is more the sort of chronic experience of boredom and something that we might refer to as a trait within an individual. And so the difference, I think, is in how you respond to state boredom. So those people that we mentioned earlier that sort of say they're never bored, the Louis C.K.'s of this world that are never bored, these are people who just respond very rapidly and quickly to that boredom signal. People who might feel like they're more bored with their lives chronically are struggling to adaptively respond to that signal and find ways to reframe their life and reframe it to make it seem more meaningful and more purposeful. And I guess that's the main distinction that I'd make there between, you know, chronically feeling like you're bored with your life and just feeling it in the moment.
How does fidgeting fit in with that, James, or does it?
How does fidgeting? Well, we don't know a hell of a lot about fidgeting, but fidgeting and doodling, you know, if you're sitting in a lecture or listening to some other kind of thing and you're doodling away, if you're on the phone and doing that kind of thing, I think that's just a really useful outlet for people who might be experiencing that boredom signal but be trapped. You know, you're not able to actually get out of the circumstance. We talked about this a little bit earlier, that in some senses there are environmental constraints that lead to boredom. You know, if you can't get out of the circumstance, I think you mentioned being in line at the DMV.
Yes.
If you can't get out of that sort of circumstance, then doing things like fidgeting or doodling or picking up your cell phone and playing Candy Crush or whatever it is people do, those are fairly adaptive responses to being bored and not having much at your disposal to deal with it.
Mary, just a quick question about the history of boredom, because I know you looked at some of this. What are some of the earliest signs of boredom as we look back in time?
Well, one of the earliest that I was able to find was these monks, I think it's 4th century, I want to say, and they were called the Desert Fathers because they just lived in the desert. They got as far away from people as they could, tucked away just for prayer, and they would write about this feeling and how, I feel like I should even read a little bit of it. It was reminding me of The Office, you know that TV show?
Absolutely.
And I was like, oh, these poor monks. And I think what really got to me about them was that they were doing something that they felt so passionately about and yet were having this feeling. And so that feeling then became also a feeling of failure.
So they were passionate about it, but they were also experiencing boredom at the same time?
Yeah, I mean, you'd have to be passionate about it to go into the to dedicate your life to God, this thing that you'll never see, and go live in the desert forever. But then to pray all day, this one monk, visiting monk, wrote that their biggest challenge was this invisible enemy that we may describe as tedium or perturbation of the heart. Such lassitude of body and craving for food as one might feel after hard toil. One gazes anxiously here and there and sighs that no brother of any description is to be seen approaching.
Wow.
One is forever in and out of one's cell.
Yeah, that sounds like boredom to me.
Yeah, wanting to snack, all that stuff.
I'm curious, James, about, I mean, teenagers will often complain or always complain about being bored. Is that something existential, or is it something about their brain development at that time, or just they can't stand being with their parents? What is that about, do you think?
Well, I think it's about a lot of the things that you mentioned there. I don't know that it's about not being able to stand being around your parents, but I think the brain development is really key. And so I'll backtrack a little bit. We've shown that, and others have shown too, that there's a strong relationship between age and boredom. So as you get older, you actually experience boredom a little bit less. But the key thing that we found recently is that that's true if you just have a very narrow age range in your sample between 17 and 22-year-olds. And what's happening between those age ranges is that the last part of your brain is coming online. So the frontal cortex, the same part of the brain that is injured in people that have car accidents that we sort of started this conversation with, the frontal cortex becomes fully matured in that age range, late teenagers, early 20-year-olds. And that part of the brain also gives you all of these sort of very sophisticated capacities for controlling your behavior, for inhibiting unwanted actions, for making sound decisions and that kind of thing. So I do think that when you think about teenagers then, they're not really fully mature until early 20s. But they're starting to develop in the early teenage years, 13 or 14, they're starting to develop some of those sophisticated skills. They're not fully developed yet, but they're starting to come online. So what you have is a circumstance where the teenager is getting these new skills that they can't deploy because they're still under the control of their parents. They still have a very constrained environment, going to school every day and doing the same sorts of things. So it's as if they have a window into their future capacity to be fully mature adults, but they're not allowed to fully exploit that. And I think that is probably one of the reasons why teenagers often report being bored, because their life circumstance is not one that they can just do whatever they like, but they have this sense in themselves that they ought to be able to.
Well, and it might explain why school children often find school boring or say that school is boring. They are not in control of their environment. Let me get Venk from Philadelphia to join us on Radio Times. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you, Marty.
You're welcome.
This question is for This question is for James. It's about cognition science, and I think you may have answered this with age, but what effect, if any, does executive function have on the propensity to be bored?
Do you want to take that, James?
It's a great question, and I think what I was just hinting at then is that executive functions, these capacities that we have for, you know, very high-level behaviors, controlling our thoughts and actions, planning ahead, thinking about the future, inhibiting unwanted sort of actions, you know, making sure you don't say the wrong thing at a party, this kind of stuff. These are very important things for controlling our behaviors in goal-directed ways. And without those kinds of skills, we may be much more likely to become bored because we can't adaptively respond to our environment and the needs that we have as individuals to fully express our sort of talents and skills. So I think there's a very strong relationship between executive function and boredom. But I should say that that's an hypothesis that I have at the moment, one that we've tested fully yet.
Very good. Veng, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let me see what Becky from Philadelphia has to say. Becky joining us on Radio Times. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. This is Becky Batra. I'm the finance editor at the Inquirer and Daily News. And I just have a fun story to pass along. And it's got a local and timely connection. So a million years ago, when I was writing a story for Child Magazine about the benefits of boredom, I spoke with the local child development guru, Kathy Hirsch-Pasek.
Oh, Temple. Sure. Yep.
And we were talking about the benefits of aimless play for children. And she told me that at the time, all the kids in the neighborhood were at specialized camps for soccer and music, and her kids were out back drawing in the dirt with sticks. Well, one of her kids grew up to be Benj Pasek, who wrote the lyrics to La La Land and Dear Evan Hansen. So I just wanted to share that. I think the creativity link is definitely pretty strong.
Well, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Mary, anything you want to say about that? I know you talked to a lot of people about boredom, and I wonder whether with children, and perhaps James, you can weigh in on this as well, about the difference between just aimless play and more organized play, if there's some boredom factor in either one of those. Mary?
Well, I guess a couple of things. I did get a chance to interview some artists and actors, and they all had stuff to say about the way that they sort of use boredom in their work. One of the actresses that I interviewed, actually, hers I really liked. She was talking about how many shoots you have to do on a TV show. So you might do, like, you know, 40 takes of the same scene. And she was saying that she finds that really helpful because by the time you get towards the end, you're so bored of the scene that you just sort of are slap happy and you just act naturally,
which is
the whole thing that you're supposed to be doing anyway.
Right.
So she sees it as a tool. But I also did get to interview some parents, and I think thinking also back to that Louis C.K. thing, a lot of what I heard was less concern about their kids being bored and more concern about when kids say they're bored, does that mean we're not parenting right? Does that mean they're spoiled in some way? Or when people get bored of their kids, does that mean that they don't love them enough?
Oh, wow. That's powerful.
Not bored of their kids, but bored just, you know, playing with Legos for the 80,000th time kind of thing.
James, you want to weigh in on that?
Well, I think you ask a great question. I don't have a good answer as to whether or not structured play or unstructured play is better for responding to boredom. But I do think when it comes to the parenting notion that we have as parents this kind of desire to fix boredom when our kids come to us and say that they're bored. And I actually think the right approach is to let them fix it. They need to learn how to respond to the signal themselves. And the most common thing that happens to a parent too when a child comes to you and says that they're bored is that all of the options that you give them to fix their boredom are dismissed anyway. So that's sort of a child's way of acknowledging that they know they need to fix it themselves.
Fair enough. Let me read an email from Michael. He says, my fourth grader recently found out who his teacher is for the next year. He is known to be very boring. I'm curious how I can keep him interested in the learning process with a boring teacher for most of each day. James, I'm going to just toss that back to you, and then Mary, let's see what you have to say. But James, you have any suggestions for Michael and his child?
Yeah, it's very difficult for for me to give advice about what to do for a 9 or 10-year-old who's decided that already that their teacher is boring. Perhaps to ask the child to give the teacher a chance, because if they have not had them before, relying on other people's reports might not be the best thing. But this notion of just reframing things.
Yeah.
You know, if the teacher does turn out to be boring for his child, to ask the child to use their own imagination and think about ways in which the class as it's being taught could be reframed. You know, and I'm not a child psychologist, so my advice is always going to be fairly it's not going to be that sophisticated, I would suggest. You know, I might tell my own child just to imagine, you know, the teacher as something else. Imagine the teacher as a wizard or something like that. Something that engages the child's imagination.
Oh, I like that. Let me get Quazit from Philadelphia to join our conversation. Quazit, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Go ahead.
So my issue is with ADHD. I was diagnosed with ADHD at the age of 30. And my question is, like, how does that affect those who have ADHD, like boredom? I've had times where my wife has told me, get off the phone, because I'm the guy who's bored sitting at the corner of the room looking at my phone.
It's a good question.
How do you deal with that?
Sure. James, I'm tossing it back to you.
Yeah, so there is a strong relationship between ADHD and boredom in both children who have been diagnosed with it and in adults such as yourself, even in people who report just higher symptomatology of ADHD but don't have the diagnosis. I'm not sure what your question is directly that I could say about that for you, that other than to let you know that, yes, boredom is associated with both the hyperactive and the inattentive symptoms of ADHD. And, in fact, one of the key things about being bored is that people who experience boredom a lot struggle to pay attention to the world in front of them or the task that they're doing right now. So the sort of that, and that's, of course, the key problem with ADHD is sort of maintaining focus and maintaining attention. So the kinds of strategies that you might want to sort of try and engage to deal with that might be the same sort of strategies that you would engage to deal with the ADHD symptoms.
Sure. Hate to do this because we're just about out of time. Quazit, thanks for calling into Radio Times. And James Danker, thank you for joining us on Radio Times as well.
My pleasure.
He's a professor of cognitive neuroscience at the University of Waterloo in Canada, director of the university's Dankert Attention Group. Mary Mann, thank you for joining us on Radio Times as well.
Oh, happy to.
And she's the author of a book called Yawn, Adventures in Boredom, and she works as a private researcher and as a writing associate at the Cooper Union. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trine Nuri. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and we do want to close things out with a song from Iggy Pop's 1979 album, New Values, I'm Bored.
Board. I'm the chairman of the board. I'm a lengthy monologue. I'm living like a dog. I'm bored. Oh, myself.